growing up in the farming community and so on, how did your interest in mathematics come about?
It was an accident in some sense, although I suppose it would have eventually happened.
I,
as a kid, I hated arithmetic. You know, mm-hmm. first, second, third grades was so boring, there wasn't anything interesting about it. But then about the summer between my seventh and eighth grades, my uncle, who was going to college at the time, dropped out of college and left his books at my grandmother's house, which was just through the woods from our house. And among those books, there was a college algebra and trig book, and there was a calculus book. And I started looking at the calculus book, at all the pictures, and seeing these kind of problems like, you know, what's the largest cylinder you can inscribe in a sphere and things like that, and thinking that how could anybody know that? How could you try them all and see which one was the biggest? And so I got really curious, how did they do this kind of stuff? And so I went back and worked my way through the algebra book and then worked my way through the calculus book. And from that point on, I was hooked.
So even though you didn't like the math, you did learn it.
I didn't like the arithmetic. That's right. Yeah, the arithmetic was kind of boring. You know, when you start, you know, after a while, you know, you're dividing three-digit numbers into five-digit numbers and things like that. I don't know if you remember long division, but it wasn't much fun. And so, you know, once you learn how to do it, there's not much to, I mean, but then you still got to do 50 exercises a night or something like that. Yeah. But once algebra, you know, once I saw algebra and saw the kinds of things that you could do with it, I was hooked. And all kinds of neat things occurred for me to think about and try. And plus I had the resources of the calculus book, which had lots of suggestive problems and connections with physics and mechanics and so forth, although I, you know.
Did you do that all on your own, though? Or?
Pretty much, yeah. I didn't have anybody, the college algebra book was really self-explanatory. And, you know, it was written at a level that, you know, if you could read and you had some interest in it, you could figure out what everything was. I didn't really learn epsilon delta kind of stuff. Although it was there, I didn't pay much attention to it because, you know, I could see it was kind of a side issue for being able to do computations, which was the thing I was really interested in, and, you know, being able to compute things. So it wasn't really until I got to college that I got an appreciation for epsilon delta stuff. But I could do the problems, and that was what I wanted to be able to do.
So did that affect your high school career?
I went to a really small high school. Yeah. And so, in fact, it was all 12 grades. I basically graduated with the 30 kids that I went to first grade with. And so there wasn't a whole lot of opportunity for math enrichment there. You know, they offered algebra and geometry in alternate years and algebra 2 in geometry in alternate years. And they had an advanced math class, but that was pretty much the only math they had. And I didn't really make any contact with people. I didn't really know that math could be a career until fairly late in high school. I remember asking my high school math teacher at one point, what was there after calculus? Because I felt like, you know, I'd learned calculus, and he said, "That's it. Calculus is there is in math. There's nothing beyond it." And I was really disappointed because I thought, "Oh no, you know, it's beautiful stuff, and there's no more of it to learn. So I'll go do something else." So I got really interested in chemistry, and some in physics. I was interested in those things, but I kept sort of working through problems more and more. I'm sure I worked every single integral in the book. And there was, by the time I got to high school, there was an old calculus book in the library there, and that was more advanced than the calculus book that my uncle had had. It actually had partial derivatives in it. So it had the beginnings of vector calculus at the end, which was kind of neat. So I was gradually learning that stuff. And then finally, sort of almost by chance, I got in contact with a professor at a local college about 20 miles away, K Campbell College it was. Now it's called Campbell University. But a math professor there, and we'd had some high school contest, the first contest our county had had, and I don't know when, and I'd done very well on it, and so he asked me what I was going to study and what I was going to do and so forth, and I said, well, I guess I'll study chemistry because I like that, and it's fun. He said, well, why not mathematics? And I said, well, but there's not any mathematics after calculus. And he laughed, as you would expect. Right. Right? And he said, oh, no, that's not true. Mm-hmm. And so my senior year, in fact, he had lent me about 10 books of various different kinds of mathematics. You know, there was a book on discrete mathematics. There was a little book on introduction to partial differential equations. There was a book on algebra, which... Mm-hmm. At the time, I didn't really see the point of, you know, it's abstract algebra, and I didn't really see the point of at the time, but, you know, I didn't, you know, I could see what groups were and the definition, but I didn't really see what, that they were going to be a really useful thing. Mm-hmm. And things like that, a little number theory, and so, so that last year, I had a lot of fun sort of sampling a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. There was a little book on calculus of variations, Oscar Bowles's lectures on the calculus of variations, that Dover reprint, which I thought was just the most marvelous book I'd ever seen. And so those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So by the time I got to college, I had a fairly good idea that there was a lot of math to know. Mm-hmm. And so I never had any... never had any doubt that I would study mathematics when I got to college.
So was that already a career option then that you were thinking of?
I didn't know what I would do. I just knew that I wanted to study math. And and once I learned enough math, I'd be able to figure out what I would do with it. Mm-hmm. Because I knew that's what I wanted to do.
So where did you go to college?
At North Carolina State University in Raleigh. That was...
So you didn't go far from home.
No, that's right. Well, I grew up on a farm, and I was going home to farm on the weekends, and pretty much did that all the way through graduate school, in fact, because I went to UNC Chapel Hill for graduate school. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't really have gone too far from home and kept that up. Mm-hmm. But once I got my PhD, I said, I've farmed enough. That's it. And so moved away.
Just going back just a bit, did the rest of your family support that kind of ideas, or was it sort of a separate world?
It was kind of a separate world. I mean, they appreciated, they certainly appreciated that I was good at math and did really well in school and so forth. And so, you know, they were expecting me to go to college. Right. I'll always remember though one day when I was reading this number theory book, and it was going on about modular arithmetic, and it had and had the equation 2 times 3 equals 0 in it, which was mod 6 of course, and my father looked at it and he said, that's wrong. And I said, no, but what they're trying to say. And he said, that's wrong. And so, he just wouldn't accept that there was anything there was anything valid about it. Mm-hmm. And I think from that point, for a long time, he thought that I was learning nonsense, mm-hmm. and was kind of impatient with me doing spending so much time reading math books. Mm-hmm. But eventually he came around. Mm-hmm. So.
I think with parents, it sometimes helps if you end up with a real job.
That's right.
What
you've
done in college.
That's true. Yeah, that's right. And of course, that happened. You know, after I got through graduate school, and I got a postdoctoral fellowship at the Institute for Advanced Study for a year, and so that was my first time really to move away from home for any length of time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, how did you settle on the particular area for your thesis, and what became your interest, your prime interest?
Yeah, so I went to graduate school at UNC thinking that I was going to study number theory, in fact, because I've been reading some books in analytic number theory, and I really like the complex variables and the kinds of things you could prove. The Legendre-Dirichlet theorem struck me as a particularly beautiful way for complex analysis and number theory to interact. But like I said, I went to UNC, and it turned out there weren't any people in number theory at UNC. Mm-hmm. So I sort of shopped around a bit, looking. You know, I took several courses in complex analysis, some courses in algebra, and so forth, and dynamical systems, because there were good people in all those areas at Chapel Hill. But then I took this course in differential geometry. I took the introductory course in differential geometry when I was a first year graduate student, and while it was interesting and fun, it kind of struck me as you know, glorified vector calculus, because it was curves and surfaces course. And so it wasn't as exciting to me as some of the other things, which seemed more exotic. But eventually, the professor who was going to become my advisor, Robert Gardner, taught this seminar on minimal surfaces, the study of minimal surfaces, which used a lot of complex analysis, particularly for studying two-dimensional minimal surfaces, and so that's when I decided I would start going to that seminar. And he was using these notes that S.S. Chern, the famous differential geometer, had written, and who had been his advisor, had written quite a while back on minimal surfaces. And so I started reading those notes, and things started clicking. It was the beauty of the complex analysis, the beauty of the moving frames method, and Lie groups, and the geometry of minimal submanifolds. I got really excited by that, and so close to the end of that seminar, I went into Robbie Gardner's office and said I wanted to study with him, and so he started me reading papers of the great Élie Cartan, and who had been sort of Chern's postdoctoral advisor, and then some papers of Chern, and started me working on the geometry of differential equations, and I just got excited by it, and that's when I knew that that's what I wanted to work on for my thesis. He managed to get a sabbatical while I was a graduate student, and he took me along with him. He went back to Berkeley, where he had been a graduate student, to spend a semester with Chern, and wrangled a way for me to get out of teaching my graduate courses. You know, I taught double one semester so that I wouldn't have to teach, and so I could be supported. And I went and lived at the International House in Berkeley for 6 months, this was in '78. And that's when I met Chern, and really started. It was really at that point then that I started working on my thesis. What would be my thesis? And it actually came very quickly. By the time by the time I was ready to come back to North Carolina, I really had all the results of my thesis. I just hadn't written them up. And so it was a very productive visit for me. Plus, I got to meet Chern, which was which was an enormous influence on my life.
Once you got your doctorate, you got the postdoc at the Institute for Advanced Studies.
That's right.
Was that in the same area, or
that was it was a they were having a special year in geometry. So this was after so I'd been to Berkeley in the spring of '78. I graduated in the spring of '79 and went to the Institute in the fall of '79. That was the first year of the NSF postdocs. The folks at UNC thought that I would be a good candidate for that. And Jim Stasheff, who was then on the faculty at UNC, as well as at Temple in Philadelphia, and had been a collaborator of Milner's, said, "I'll ask Milner to be your mentor," and Milner agreed to do that. He wrote a letter, and so I got a postdoc, and spent a year at the Institute for Advanced Study. And it was a great year because that was this big geometry year. They had Yao was there, mm-hmm. Rick Shane was there, Karen Uhlenbeck was there, Julianne Turing was there. Mm-hmm. just fabulous geometers, great mm-hmm. people were there. And there were like 5 seminars running mm-hmm. and talks every day in mm-hmm. differential geometry. And so that was when I really got exposed to what I would call modern differential geometry. Mm-hmm. I'd had this wonderful grounding in classical differential geometry. You know, I'd mm-hmm. learned how to read Cartan's papers and Chern's papers, and had been sort of introduced into that school of doing things with the moving frame and the method mm-hmm. of equivalence. And so I had developed a real love of that subject, but I hadn't really learned estimates or mm-hmm. modern differential geometry. The kinds of things that Yao and Shane were doing, and that Karen Uhlenbeck was doing, kind mm-hmm. of that, you know, really bringing analysis into the subject. Mm-hmm. And so that year I got exposed to all of that, and that was another great year. I mean, I can't tell you how much that influenced my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, that year of being around people who were not only brilliant mathematicians but generous with their time and especially mm-hmm. a fresh postdoc that mm-hmm. They didn't know much about. Mm-hmm. They were really good.
Milner there too?
Milner was there. Yeah. He was my advisor, and he was my mentor, mm-hmm. and we didn't actually interact a whole lot. I mean, we had some conversations about some interesting mm-hmm. things in conformal geometry and things like that, but he was really more interested in topology and dynamics already mm-hmm. by that time, mm-hmm. and so he wasn't so closely tied to mm-hmm. the differential geometry folks, mm-hmm. and I was really drawn to the differential geometry area. So mm-hmm. so we had conversations. He'd ask mm-hmm. me how I was doing, and he would be encouraging,
right.
but I really learned a lot from those other guys. Yeah.
Now, at some point, you had to start looking for a job.
Ah, yes. Well, in fact, I did look for a job when I got my degree mm-hmm. In 79. And I already had, what had happened was I applied a lot of places. And one place in particular I applied was Rice University.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that I was going around giving my job talks, I guess this was in February, mm-hmm. January and February of 1979, there was a real cold spell on the East Coast,
mm-hmm.
and I spent more than one day snowed in an airport when mm-hmm. I was traveling around trying mm-hmm. to get various places to give job talks, and so when I went down to Rice.
Mm-hmm.
It was 75 degrees. It was nice and warm. The mm-hmm. flowers were in bloom, and I thought, this is where I want to be. So the people at Rice were really wonderful folks. They were it's a small department, but a very active one. Bochner was still there, and he had retired from Princeton mm-hmm. and moved down to Rice. He'd been chair for. He wasn't chair at the time I was mm-hmm. there, but he had been chair for 8 years before he stepped down from being chair at Rice. And there were all these great people like Reese Harvey and John Polking that were a lot of fun to be around. Mm-hmm. Had lots of interesting things mm-hmm. to talk about and learn. And so I was there. I had a great time, and they made an offer, and I took mm-hmm. it. And they allowed me to delay it for a year,
uh-huh.
so that I could go to the Institute for Advanced Study mm-hmm. for this postdoc,
yeah.
which they thought, I thought, and they agreed that it would be really good for me yeah. to have that year at the Institute.
Uh-huh.
So they made me an assistant professor offer and delayed it for a year so mm-hmm. that I could go to, so that I could go mm-hmm. to. The Institute, and of course, that was great. It was
yeah.
uh, But then in the summer of 1980, the first week that I moved to Houston, it was over 100 every day. It was July of 1980.
Yeah.
And it was over 100 every day, and, you know, 90% humidity. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what have I gotten myself into? I mean, I'd grown up in the South and on a farm, in fact, and so I was no stranger to heat and humidity, but Houston was another order of magnitude.
Yes.
So it was a little bit of a shock, but the department was so great. It was such a welcoming place, and Bochner mm-hmm. was really supportive. And Morton Curtis was there, was alive then, still, and very much fun to talk with, and mm-hmm. and you know, John Hempel and Peter Shalen were there. It was Mark Culler, mm-hmm. so it was a active department. It was a very collegial mm-hmm. department, and they made me, even though I was kind of the most junior member, they made me feel like one of the gang almost immediately, and. And so I had a great time at Rice. It's a, mm-hmm. you know, it's a small university, or it was then. There were about 4,000 undergraduates. I think it's increased some in size since then. But you know, it was on the college system, but the ratio of students to faculty was pretty low, and so you got to know a lot of your students, and there was, you know, there was a lot of appreciation for good teaching, mm-hmm. And so I was encouraged in many ways there, and so I really like Rice. It mm-hmm. was a wonderful department, and still is.
Mm-hmm. So you transitioned from Rice to
I also, the other big influence on me that I didn't mention yet is that in December of 79, Chern. Who had read my thesis and wanted to promote it and, mm-hmm. and get other people interested in that area, gave a course that fall mm-hmm. in differential systems, exterior differential mm-hmm. systems, which was the subject my thesis was in, and planned at the end of the course he was going to have a conference mm-hmm. on exterior differential systems. And he invited me to come and give a talk, but also invited Philip Griffiths, who had worked with Chern mm-hmm. a lot, and was also interested in applying these techniques of exterior differential systems to algebraic and differential geometry.
Mm-hmm.
And so that December, I met Philip Griffiths, and we clicked immediately. There were all kinds of interesting problems and questions that he had on his mind mm-hmm. to work on, with great applications. He had tremendous insight into things, mm-hmm. And so we started up a conversation right away.
Mm-hmm.
And all that spring, in the spring of 80, we were writing letters back and forth. I went up to visit mm-hmm. him a few times, and we started working together.
Mm-hmm.
And so even by the time I got to Rice, I was already working with Philip Griffiths.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I, so we started this collaboration that went on for almost 20 years. Things, mm-hmm. you know, papers we worked, projects we'd work mm-hmm. on, papers we'd write, books.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big influence on me, but I also learned a lot of algebraic geometry from Philip.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point I guess it was about 1983-84, Philip got offered the position of provost at Duke University,
mm-hmm.
and he moved there.
He
had been at Harvard.
Oh, okay.
He was a professor at Harvard, but, you know, before that at Princeton, before that at Berkeley. He'd been kind of at all the big places, right?
Yes.
And he took this job as provost at Duke, and he immediately asked me if I would be interested in coming to Duke. We could continue our collaboration when he would, mm-hmm. while he was at Duke. And then we'd be together in some place, which, you know, given my aversion to cold weather, there was mm-hmm. no chance I was going to move to Boston.
Uh-huh.
But Duke, you know, 60 miles from where I grew up, even less now, I guess, really, 50 miles from where I grew up, Duke was more like it. And so, in fact, in 1987, I got an offer from Duke and decided to go. and so that Philip and I could collaborate more. And mm-hmm. so we moved up to Chapel Hill, mm-hmm. and I went to Duke. My family was pleased about that. The whole time that I'd been living in Texas, my grandmother would write every now and then and say, "When are you coming home?" Mm-hmm. She couldn't imagine mm-hmm. that I would ever settle somewhere yeah. away from family. Right. So she said, "You don't know those people. They're not. I mean, this is typical, farm family kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You just don't move far from your home." Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm one of six kids, and of those, of all my brothers and sisters, I'm the only one that lives probably more than 5 miles from where he or she was born. Mm. So, I'm definitely the outlier as far mm-hmm. as that goes. So I moved to Duke and had a great time there. Mm-hmm. Duke's also another really wonderful collegial department and very mm-hmm. supportive. With Philip there and other people that came afterwards, people like Dick Hain, mm-hmm. John Harrer, mm-hmm. We had a lot of common interests and there was a lot of good differential geometry there. Mark Stern and Les Saper were there, Yao students, mm-hmm. And so on. So it was a good department to be in. David Morrison mm-hmm. was there, mm-hmm. a Philip Griffith student. And so it was a collegial department, lots of interesting activity going mm-hmm. on. I stayed 20 years. Mm-hmm. So,
now, Philip Griffith himself went on to the Institute for Advanced Study.
That's right. In the early 90s, yeah. So Philip had been provost for a while and had done a wonderful job. People at Duke mm-hmm. still talk about mm-hmm. the Griffiths era. Mm-hmm.
And he still had time to do research.
He still had time to do research.
Remarkable in itself.
It is remarkable. And I've become much more appreciative of that now that I'm myself an administrator. Mm-hmm. And much more impressed. Mm-hmm. Not that I wasn't impressed then. Mm-hmm. So Philip and I continued to work. He didn't work quite at the pace he'd done before, mm-hmm. but Philip's pace was ferocious anyway. Mm-hmm. So to slow down a little bit still meant that he was publishing at the rate that most mathematicians would be proud of. Mm-hmm. He got this offer to come and be the director at the Institute for Advanced Study. I mean, and I think in a certain sense, he'd done a lot of sort of restructuring of Duke and thought hard about how he thought it ought to go, and mm-hmm. he kind of set in motion what he thought was the mm-hmm. right way for Duke to go, and there was less need for, it was less challenging for him, I mm-hmm. think. And the result was that he's the kind of guy that always looks for more challenges, mm-hmm. and so when the people at the Institute for Advanced Study approached him, he took it on. Mm-hmm. And so he moved up there. We continued to collaborate. I would mm-hmm. go up, I took a few semesters off and spent semesters as a member at the Institute for Advanced Study while we worked on papers and books, essentially, mm-hmm. all the very long papers. Mm-hmm. So we continued to collaborate for years after that. Mm-hmm.
Now, you've talked a lot about the research, all the ongoing research mm-hmm. and so on. And I can ask you how that research has shifted, but there's the other side of it, the teaching part. How did that fit in, and how important was that to you?
Yeah, well, I've always loved teaching. Mm-hmm. Even when I was a graduate student, I really enjoyed thinking about ways to make the class interesting. Even when I was only teaching calculus, I was always trying to think of ways to make the class interesting. One semester I tried teaching non-standard calculus mm-hmm. to the students with the idea that if they were afraid of epsilon delta, maybe they wouldn't be so afraid if we actually used infinitesimals and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And I would say it had kind of mixed success. It was the thing that upset them more than that there was anything hard about it was that it was not what the other students were learning.
Mm-hmm.
And and so, you know, they were afraid that they were being guinea pigs, or mm-hmm. or that they wouldn't be able to talk to their other students, and you know, they couldn't share problems or anything like that. Nowadays, you know, the way we organize classes, you know, beginning calculus, where there's a lot more mm-hmm. control over the individual sections, I don't think you could do that. Mm-hmm. But like I said, it was a mixed success. I enjoyed it, and I think they did too, once they got over the shock of it not being mm-hmm. what they were expecting.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I always enjoyed thinking about, you know, how would you prepare a lecture on this, or what would people worry about, or, you know, how could mm-hmm. you learn to anticipate those and allay mm-hmm. those concerns. And so I spent a lot of time on teaching and enjoyed, you know, whether it's because I enjoyed it or what, it was, I got pretty good ratings, mm-hmm. I would say. And the students, my students seemed to be appreciative. I mean, I don't want to brag, but mm-hmm. you know, I got teaching awards mm-hmm. and in fact, one of the most, I would say, you know, one of the things I like the best on my CV is that I got the MAA Southeast Distinguished mm-hmm. Teaching Award 1 year when I was teaching at Duke, and it was for a course again, you know, because you had more freedom in an honors course. I was tapped to teach the honors calculus course, mm-hmm. which was actually sort of honors vector calculus. And the way the course was originally designed, it was you did the, you know, the standard 2 and 3 variable calculus in the fall, and then in the spring mm-hmm. you do linear algebra, and that always struck me as backwards, that linear algebra really should precede vector calculus,
mm-hmm.
and the only trouble is trying to figure out how to get students to appreciate linear algebra mm-hmm. when you don't have calculus. Mm-hmm. You know, because linear algebra by itself always seems kind of flavorless
mm-hmm.
when you get started, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, vector spaces are kind of bare things.
Yes.
There's not much to them.
Yeah.
And so I decided I would rearrange the curriculum. I told the students when I walked in the first mm-hmm. day, this is a 2-semester course, but in fact it's a year course. And if you're going to stick with me for the fall semester, you're pretty much going to be committed to stick with me for the spring semester, because I will cover mm-hmm. all the same material, but it's going to be in a very different order, and we're going to go at it in what I think is a more natural way, and I hope you'll gain a real appreciation for mm-hmm. Vector analysis and multivariable calculus when it's over with, and in fact, you know, I had. It was an honors class, so it wasn't very big. There were 23 students to begin with, and I finished at the end of the year with 21.
Mm-hmm.
And we did things the way I thought they should be done, you know, introducing mm-hmm. vector spaces and enough linear algebra to really get started, so that you can introduce derivatives the right way mm-hmm. in vector calculus, and gradually build up all the tools that you need to really do, to really end up at the end with... you know, the real fundamental theorems, you know, Stokes, Greens, and the fundamental theorem of calculus, the big mm-hmm. picture. And so that's what we did. And I wrote, basically, we didn't have a book. I wrote a set of lecture notes like that thick,
mm-hmm.
And passed them out. And we just, I had a great time doing it. And I think that was one of the things that they used as the basis of my of nominating me mm-hmm. for the Southeast mm-hmm. The MAA Southeast Teaching Award,
mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing I've always liked to do with mm-hmm. classes. I spend a lot of time thinking about what's the real right order to do mm-hmm. things in, and often I come up with different answers mm-hmm. from what I see in the books, and so mm-hmm. So I, you know, I like to move things around, so. And I've tried to teach most of the undergraduate mm-hmm. and graduate courses I've done that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually use my own notes.
Mm-hmm.
Uh, once in a while, you know, when it's a course that really has to fit in with other courses, or you're in a multi-section mm-hmm. course that where there has to be a lot of interconnection, you don't have that much freedom, and of course mm-hmm. you can do that. And I try to make those work, you know, well too. I mean, we mm-hmm. A lot of these things are very collaborative, and it's mm-hmm. important to bring your insights to the table and listen to others. Mm-hmm. But the ones that I really enjoy are the ones that I get to, you know, rearrange as mm-hmm. I see fit, mm-hmm. and those are the ones I think I've been the most successful with. So, mm-hmm. but it is a big part of my life. I think. And I always tell my graduate students that, if you're going to have a career as an academic mathematician, a large part of what you do is you're going to be teaching. And you need to be sure that this is something you know how to do and that you enjoy doing if you're going to be happy in this life. So I encourage them not to try to get out of mm-hmm. teaching, you know, like, I mean, it's one thing to get a research assistantship when you're working on your thesis, but mm-hmm. but you don't want to spend too many semesters, I think, as a graduate student without teaching.
Yeah.
So, just for your own personal growth.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to encourage my graduate mm-hmm. students to enjoy teaching, too.
The other piece of it that sometimes graduate students forget is that they'll also spend a lot of their time writing one thing or another.
Absolutely, that's right.
And being able yeah. to communicate effectively and well,
right.
that's not always taught as well as it could be, but it's an important part of what they
that's true.
Are doing.
That's right, yeah. Writing is really important, and I tend to spend a lot of time going over my students' thesis work mm-hmm. with them, you know, trying to get them to think about how they're writing things up and how well they're communicating what they're thinking about and mm-hmm. doing, how well they're selling their viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to write clearly and effectively to do that. Mm-hmm. Once you start reading these long, complicated, torturous sentences that you forget where the subject is and
yeah.
sometimes the verb, you don't continue that very long. Right. And when you send out your thesis written that way, you're not going to get that many people reading it.
Yeah.
So
what attracted you to the MSRI position?
So that's a good question. I never really saw myself as an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
I was, in fact, I've never even been department chair before I took the job. So it's so there was some trepidation about it. I guess it was a combination of things. One was seeing Philip go into administration
mm-hmm.
and do something really creative and useful to other people with it.
Mm-hmm.
Convinced me that administration done well was an important part of our service. And so there was you reach a certain point in your life when you feel that you've been given a lot,
mm-hmm.
and because we live in many ways a very nice life,
mm-hmm.
As research mathematicians,
mm-hmm.
and you know that doesn't come for free. I mean,
mm-hmm.
somebody puts a lot of time and work
mm-hmm.
into making this possible. And so that was one thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
a sense that I owed something to the mathematics community, and so here was a chance to be able to do something.
Mm-hmm.
MSRI particularly, because MSRI was founded by S.S. Chern,
mm-hmm.
my mathematical grandfather,
mm-hmm.
whom I've admired,
mm-hmm.
Since I was in graduate school, since I first learned about him, in
mm-hmm.
fact. And so MSRI, I spent some time at MSRI when it first opened in 82 and
mm-hmm.
83. I was a frequent visitor earlier in my career, and I felt that it had given a lot to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'd learned a lot there. I've met a lot of really good people. And so they were looking for somebody. I felt that I had a particular connection to MSRI.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that MSRI was an important institution for mathematics research and now education and outreach, because you know MSRI has become very involved in math circles and you know the public perception of mathematics, and so all those things made it seem like that was a good place to get involved, and they came and asked me if I would do it. And at first, frankly, at first I said no, because I had a lot of doubts about my ability to take on such an operation, and being uprooted and going across the country, it wasn't clear that it would be a smooth transition at all. They talked with me about it, and the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, you know, it's possible that I could. Mm-hmm. That I could be effective, I could be helpful in this, and it is time I did something for the community. So I accepted the position, and it's been a tremendous learning experience. It's very different from anything that I've done before. You spend a lot of time solving problems that aren't strictly mathematical. Mm-hmm. Probably the most frustrating thing about being at MSRI is those days when I go in and I see, oh, that's a great talk that's going to be on this afternoon, but I have a committee meeting then. And there's no way I can move all these committee meetings around to avoid all the great talks. And so a lot of really interesting and beautiful mathematics gets done at MSRI that I don't get to take part in. I suppose that's inevitable, but still, you know, you feel it. I don't have as much time to do research as I did, and definitely my publishing has slowed, and the time I get to think about mathematics has slowed down, and I miss that the most. But I do feel that we're making progress at MSRI. I mean, there are lots of things, lots of ways that MSRI can improve its services and extend its outreach, and we're working on those. I have some wonderful people on my staff. My deputy director, Ellen Barcelo, is wonderful. Dave Ockley, the associate director. We have a good group, and a great facility. It was enlarged in 2006 dramatically with a lot of help from the Simons Foundation. But a lot of other people contributed as well. It's been a real community effort. I think MSRI has grown and been successful because mathematicians and the public feel that the MSRI is serving a very vital role in research and education now, and it's an honor to be of assistance in that enterprise.
Probably one of the nicest or most useful things they did on the IP side. I was always impressed with what they were doing in outreach. I mean, I was hearing about MSRI early on, especially compared to the other math institutes, because there was more of an outreach. The Fermat's Last Theorem, whole extravaganza that they put on and so on. So that came up early, but putting in their journalist in residence program had a big effect. I was there in 99, and it was just for the summer, but and it was a chance to live in Berkeley, which was wonderful. But beyond that, it was it gave me the sense of what it's like being in mathematical research. There was an excellent summer program that year. This was random matrix theory and all those things involving and stuff.
You know, we have a random matrix theory program going on right now.
I noticed that on the listing. Right. Yes.
Yeah. So.
But I think even for the, there are others who I know who are also went through that program. It has an impact. Maybe not directly in sort of an immediate story and whatever, but it really does have an impact.
That's something that I would really like to see MSRI do more of. We don't have a journalist in residence currently right now, but the ones that we have had have been wonderful people, and I'd like to find a sort of systematic way of sort of advertising for that position and letting people who might be interested in it know, because I think there is a lot of potential, and there's obviously a lot of need for getting the word out to people about what's going on in the world of research mathematics and how it affects their lives.
Yeah.
You know, right now, one of the things that we're doing, we also have this inverse problems program running this fall, and Gunther Ullmann is the lead organizer. One of the things that they often talk about when they give public presentations is cloaking and invisibility, right? These methods of basically making things invisible by distorting the wave field around something, so, which is really interesting. You know, they're actually working on building such objects is even more fascinating. But there are lots of these fundamental things in mathematics that are connected with things that are evolving technology that people should know about, and so getting somebody there who can write effectively about it would be a really good thing. I need to find a way to do that, because I think that there are. There's a handful of science writers in the country that are doing like yourself, that are doing really good writing, but there's room for a lot more, I think. And I think there's a thirst for it in the public when it's well done, and is not sort of a distillation of some research announcement in science that most people can't read. My own experience talking with everyday people is that they are curious about what's going on in the sciences and mathematics, and mystified by the fact that everything seems to be a black box now. We have amazing devices that most people have no idea how they work. Even the mathematical principles on which they work, they don't know. Which is too bad. It's not like it's beyond comprehension.
I think I'll finish off with two questions. One is, where do you see yourself 10 years from now?
10 years roughly. From now? I don't think that I'll still be the director of MSRI. I really look forward to the time that I have more time to do research. And so I'm hoping that I'll be somewhere working on interesting problems. That's what I've always enjoyed doing, and I now have a backlog of all kinds of things, projects that I've written down and thought, if I just had time to work on that would be great. I want to clear out some of that backlog. And learn some new things. So I see myself sort of back doing full-time research. I certainly hope in 10 years, exactly where I'll be, I don't know, but that's what I hope to be doing.
And finally, just your talk tonight. Autonomy and motion and analyzing motion. How does that fit in with the kind of research you've been doing? Why that topic, and how does it then come out of all, now that we've gone through all your background and experience?
The idea of holonomy is, and a lot of people pronounce it differently. Yes. I recognize that sort of the standard English pronunciation guide has the syllable going on the second, has the accent going on the second syllable, so people say holonomy. But it comes from two Greek words, holo and nomos, and so I tend to put the accent on the third syllable for the nomos, holonomy. The idea, as I'll explain in the talk, about being able to understand how constrained motion, how much freedom do you have when you constrain your motion by some rolling constraint or differential equations, things like that. That fundamental underlying idea shows up in a lot of different things. I really came to it by Riemannian geometry. And in the physical sense, this it was observed already back in the early part of the 20th century by Schouten and Cartan that a lot of the properties that we understand about curvature of space can be understood in terms of holonomy. That is, mm-hmm. if you take a frame field, like an inertial frame field in an inertial guidance system, and you fly it around in mm-hmm. space, when you come back, even though it thinks it's stayed mm-hmm. unrotated all the time, you come back and it's rotated somewhat. Mm-hmm. And that's a measure of the curvature of space around the path mm-hmm. that you're doing. And in fact, you can see this. We've gotten so good that even though our instruments have gotten so good now that we can actually measure the curvature of space by mm-hmm. measuring this holonomy. You know, you send up an inertial guidance system in a plane and mm-hmm. fly it around and come back, and you can actually detect the curvature of the Earth now by the forced rotation of mm-hmm. these gyroscopic mm-hmm. systems, right? And so it'd been recognized since the 20s that there was this intimate connection between curvature, the intrinsic curvature of space, and this kind of rotation caused by parallel transport around loops, and so that became the subject of holonomy, of understanding mm-hmm. how this failure of the exact law, mm-hmm. which ought to be called non-holonomy, but it's mm-hmm. called holonomy. Reflects the curvature and the underlying properties of the space. And the way I got involved in it actually was back in the 1950s, Berger and Berger and others worked out what the possible holonomy groups were for Riemannian manifolds. Mm-hmm. It turned out that it was a very restricted list. And what it was basically they used their techniques to knock out all but a few possibilities. Mm-hmm. But that didn't prove that they all occurred. And Jim Simons, who has mm-hmm. been so important in MSRI's history and was also a collaborator of Chern's, mm-hmm. had also in his thesis found another proof, a very beautiful proof, that here were the only possible list of holonomies of irreducible Riemannian manifolds. And the first case where, you know, by the time I got interested in it, which was in the early 80s, the first case that wasn't known whether or not it really could occur, it was on the list of possibilities, but nobody knew an example, mm-hmm. was in dimension 7, the group G2, which is a subgroup of the rotations in dimension 7. It's the first of the mm-hmm. exceptional groups. The five exceptional lead groups, and there was a question about whether or not it really could occur. There was none of the ways of ruling it out could knock it out, but nobody had any construction of one. And I looked at it from the point of view of solving a differential equations problem. Mm-hmm. It turns out that with some work, you can convert it into a problem of solving differential equations. Mm-hmm. And it turned out I had the right tool, the Cartan-Kähler theorem, mm-hmm. to do it. And I was able to prove that there really did exist these special holonomy groups in dimension 7, mm-hmm. that's a G2, which was a purely sort of abstract construction, although I was able to, after that, once I knew what mm-hmm. the properties were, to actually make a construction. And that was published in the Annals, so mm-hmm. my first Annals paper. And at the time, it was kind of a mathematical curiosity. But then the physicists got interested in it. Mm-hmm. It turned out that you know, string theory, as we understand it, is a theory in 10 dimensions, with 4 observable dimensions in the real world, and then sort of these very curled up tightly 6 dimensions. Mm-hmm. Where the holonomy group was this group called SU3, mm-hmm. and it had turned out that the existence of this holonomy group, this special holonomy, implied that there were lots of interesting special properties. All these identities happened, and you can make predictions, and so that's how string theory really exploded. Mm-hmm. It started making mathematical predictions that we had not known how to do. But it was all based on this parallel spinners that were caused by the mm-hmm. caused by the reduction of holonomy. Well, eventually they decided that string theory wasn't quite strong enough to model what they were doing, and they needed to go up one dimension in dimension 7 with 7-dimensional fibers, and they still needed parallel spinners, and lo and behold, that meant it had to be G2. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden I started getting letters from physicists about questions about G2 holonomy manifolds. And that's how I got kind of drawn into the subject mm-hmm. again, and the subject took off.
Mm-hmm.
That and 8-dimension spin 7. So, you know, there's a huge amount of work in this area mm-hmm. now. In the meantime, over the years, I've run across holonomy in different problems, different areas in differential mm-hmm. geometry, in one way or another, and it's always occurred to me. You know, it's a little funny that such a fundamental notion, and people aren't familiar with it. They don't mm-hmm. learn about it until graduate school mm-hmm. or something like that. And I always thought that was too bad. Because there's a beautiful idea in there, and you can actually explain what it is, and give some simple visual examples without overwhelming people with formulas. And so that's why I decided to try and give a talk about the idea of holonomy.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you.
Okay, mm-hmm. thank you.